Maine's CDC director with the latest guidance on COVID-19. The more we learn about COVID-19, it seems, the more questions there are, and the more difficult the decisions become about reopening parts of our society. At the center of these big questions here in Maine is Dr. Nirav Shah, the head of Maine's Center for Disease Control. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Dr. Shah answers your questions about the very latest information on COVID-19 and the state's response to the pandemic. As we learn of another outbreak, this time at a memory care facility, we'll discuss new guidance for congregate care facilities. We'll also discuss Maine's transmission rate, increased testing capacity, screening for antibodies, contact tracing, and new federal funding for Maine. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Maine is at a transition point in responding to the COVID-19 pandemic. Testing for the virus is increasing, and at the same time, more places and businesses are reopening. Today, we'll talk with Maine's director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Nirav Shah, to hear about the state's latest efforts and to take your questions. Dr. Shah, as always, thank you so much for taking the time to be on Maine Calling today.
Well, thank you for having me back on, Jennifer.
And as always, we want to hear from you in the audience. What do you want to know about getting tested for COVID-19 or for antibodies, or about what your family might be, the kind of decisions they might be facing? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. This program is part of Maine Public's reporting project, Deep Dive Coronavirus. I need to say right off the bat, Dr. Shah, we already have more questions than we can get to this hour. And to all of you listening, I will try to get to as many of them as possible. I want to start with the really unfortunate news from overnight, Dr. Shah, that we've had another outbreak, this one a large outbreak in Cape Elizabeth at a memory care unit, a place that cares for people with Alzheimer's and dementia. My understanding, and tell me if this is wrong, that it was one positive test that led to a testing of everybody there. Is that correct?
That's right. For the past 2 weeks or so, our team of medical epidemiologists has been evaluating under what conditions we would move toward testing everybody in a congregate care setting. And it just so happened that when we received word of a single positive staff member at Cape Elizabeth, we had just been around the same time finalizing our move toward this policy. So it was a good opportunity to utilize the expanded testing capacity that we had just recently brought online at Maine CDC's lab up here in Augusta. We moved forward with providing a team of nurses a bunch of swabs, and yesterday evening we learned that there were in total 57 cases, 45 residents and 12 staff associated with the center that had tested positive. Our immediate concern in those situations is to protect the health and safety of everyone associated with that institution, be they residents or staff. We immediately deployed an emergency dispatch of PPE to keep folks safe there. And now we're beginning the process of working with them to address staffing needs. There was a call late last night to work with the facility to talk about staffing, infection control, all the other things that they've already been doing that we just want to help with even more.
I can imagine the challenges of treating this and caring for someone are only exacerbated by the fact that it's a memory care unit.
That does add an additional layer of challenge. It means that we've got to be especially solicitous of people's health at a time when they may not fully be able to comply with some of the best advice, whether that's social distancing or wearing masks. Every outbreak is different. Every outbreak is unique. Our primary goal is always to take care of those who are affected. And this is an example of where each outbreak has different challenges. In this situation, we really wanted to make sure that we could provide sort of culturally aware or medically aware advice given the residents who live there.
Some are asking now, ought we not be just testing everybody in every congregate care facility, but especially those that serve the older population?
that's something that we've thought about as well. One of the challenges in those situations is that if someone hasn't been exposed, if you get a negative test, we don't quite know how to interpret that. It could be that you never were exposed to coronavirus at all. It could also mean that you were recently exposed and the virus just hasn't had enough time to replicate inside your body in order to be detected. There's also concerns at the mass population level when you start talking about testing thousands of people per day. In a state like Maine, where even though we have about just under 2,000 cases, we're still very, very low on the national scale in terms of states and the number of cases we've got. So in light of that, we also have to take into account that no test is perfect, and we might get a couple of false positives. How we deal with those false positives against a setting where at the baseline, very, very, very few people have the disease, it's not a reason not to do universal mass testing. It's just something we have to think through ahead of time.
Okay. But so to be clear, it used to be the state's policy there had to be 3 cases for something to be considered an outbreak or considered for testing everybody. And now that has changed to 1 case. If there's 1 case in a congregate care facility, everyone is tested.
That is correct. The definition of what constitutes an outbreak is still 3 or more cases that are epidemiologically linked in some way. What we changed was our recommendation that facilities undertake universal testing in any sort of congregate living setting after a single person affiliated with that setting has diagnosed as positive. It's still a challenge for facilities to undertake that, but our laboratory now, with our expanded capacity up here in Augusta, our laboratory is able to accommodate those in a way that just even a week ago we would not have been able to. It really, the necessary precondition in order for us to move toward this more expansive testing policy was the expanded capacity that we were able to bring online at our laboratory in Augusta.
And you did just announce, it was only a week ago, though it seems like so much longer, that Maine was able to dramatically expand its testing capacity. I'm wondering how many tests a day we're up to now, and also in that week when we've really had expanded capacity, what have we learned? And I'm thinking beyond the numbers, what have we learned from the expanded capacity?
Great. So I'll give the numbers in terms of what our capacity was and what we're able to do now. Previously, and it was actually just Monday we announced that. If you can believe it, in COVID time, Monday seems like years ago, but it was just a few days ago. And previous to that announcement of expanded capacity, the expanded capacity we announced late last week and the policy change we announced on Monday, previous to that, we were able to do approximately 2,000 tests per week. Now our total weekly capacity is more than 3 times as great, about 7,000 per week. And we have started to hit that just yesterday alone. Just yesterday, our lab received 1,018 samples, and that was as of 6:30 p.m. We might have even received more after that. What we've learned as a result of the increased testing is that the complexion of the outbreak in Maine and in many other states is really one where there are two predominant features. The first is the high number of cases in congregate living settings, as we were talking about, whether those are memory care centers, long-term care facilities, shelters for people experiencing homelessness, very, very crowded workspaces. Those are the types of places we're starting to see a lot of new cases pop up. But then the other thing we've learned is that the follow-on effects of those initial outbreaks are where we then see a spike in cases 3 to 4 days later. So this is, for example, the spouses or siblings or housemates of people that may have been affiliated with that first outbreak. Then, as those folks go home, they unfortunately pass the virus on to those folks in their close circles. And then we see those cases pop up a couple days later.
I'm going to go to an email from Patricia because this is related to what we're talking about. She writes, numbers of cases seem to have increased since we have begun to open for business. I realize many of these numbers are in congregate settings and also that we are doing more testing and should expect numbers to go up. I would like to know if statistics can be broken out to show if there is or isn't community spread due to the opening of a business, or if you can report the increase in cases outside the isolated or congregate outbreaks. And I think Patricia is asking a question. We see the numbers every day that your office releases of how many positive cases, how many deaths, and we're wondering, How many of those are in one of these congregate care settings or one of these places where there's a cluster of cases, and how many are not related to those at all?
Mm-hmm. So that is one reason why, maybe not every day now because we've got such a long list, but at least two or three times a week, I like to read through the total number of cases that have been detected in congregate care settings. Overall, it really does vary on a daily basis depending on when we detect an outbreak. A couple of days ago, last weekend to be exact, we detected an outbreak at a seafood processing plant, and that drove up our case numbers. And after we had tested everybody associated with that, things came to a bit more of a standstill there. What we've really learned is that there continues to be community transmission in at least four counties. We haven't detected it, and we look quite frequently for signs of community transmission in the remaining 12 counties. And thus far, we haven't detected it. What we continue to see is high numbers of cases initially associated with congregate care settings, and then a few days after that, an uptick in individuals who are closely linked to those first set of cases.
How many of the cases are not that we've had so far do not fall into either of those categories? Is it half?
So the number of total community transmission cases is roughly about a quarter of our total number of cases. That is to say, those are individuals who don't have any known connection with a single identified case. And for those, we have seen that almost entirely in the four counties where community transmission has been identified. We've seen some degree of unaffiliated cases in Kennebec County, but it hasn't yet reached our threshold for declaring it community transmission. That being said, I would be remiss if I didn't note for folks that even if your county has not been one where community transmission has been identified, where it's met the somewhat strict mathematical definition that we abide by, even if you don't live in one of those areas, I still strongly recommend that everybody go about their day as if coronavirus were all around them. It really is one of those situations where in any state, and especially in Maine, once it's somewhere, we should assume that it's everywhere. And so even if it hasn't been officially deemed to be at a community level in your county, my view is that it's best to go about your day as if it already is.
I'm going to go to a question from Tara Lynn on Facebook because this represents a question I think a lot of people have. She asks, the CDC has concluded that transmission has not come from touching surfaces, but from person-to-person transmission. Will Maine adjust their protocols for businesses in light of this report? And I want to ask you about the first part as well, Dr. Shaw. Is that true? As we're seeing more evidence and learning more about this, is there more and more evidence that surfaces are not really where it's being transmitted?
So the answer there is that it's a bit of a mixed bag. I want to start by going back to what things were in the beginning. It's always been known that COVID-19 is fundamentally a respiratory virus, and the overwhelming majority of the transmission of COVID-19 occurs through people transmitting it through coughing, sneezing, things of that nature. We now know that singing can be associated with that. That's always been the case. There was always a theoretical question of whether you could potentially touch a surface where COVID-19 was, and then perhaps touch your mouth or touch your eyes and transmit it that way. It's always been theoretically possible, and there's been some new data to suggest that it's still possible, but even less likely than we thought before. So, for example, if before we thought that 99% of all transmission occurred through respiratory droplets, now we think it might be 99.5%. So we're even more sure that it's predominantly respiratory. But that doesn't mean it's impossible for it to be transmitted by surfaces. It might be possible on the occasional case, but it's probably not responsible for large outbreaks. That being said, my view is that, again, it's still not a bad idea to make sure you're still washing your hands, you're still doing all of those things that even reduce the risk as low as possible.
We're having this conversation on a beautiful day at the beginning of a beautiful Memorial Day weekend. The forecast is terrific. And Randy on Facebook asks, can kids get out and play with each other?
That's a great question, Randy. It's something that we talk about. It's something that I've thought a lot about as well, especially given the beautiful weather that you mentioned, Jennifer, that's coming our way, not just now, but in for the future. And I think, Randy, the answer to your question is, generally speaking, yes. But I think it's important for everyone to bear in mind that even though the weather is better, we're still not in a world with zero risk. In fact, I don't think we were ever in a world with zero risk. And so the same recommendations that we've talked about for adults, I think, equally apply to children. I think it's just as important, if not more important now than it ever was, for kids to make sure they're washing their hands and overall practicing good hygiene. It's just as important for parents to know who in their playgroup, in their kids' playgroup, might not be feeling well, and asking the parents of that child to maybe not have that child come play that day. But we also know that it's important for kids to get outside. It's important for kids to socialize. It's important for them to exercise. So I think if we all go into this eyes wide open, recognizing that the same prudent steps to keep kids safe and healthy that were always in place are just perhaps a bit more heightened now, then everyone can stay safe.
And I'll ask a follow-up question to that, which is it better to be playing outside than inside?
Yes.
that's the shortest answer of the week, right?
and that's for so many reasons, not just COVID-19. There's the beneficial effects of just being outdoors, the vitamin D, the connection with nature. So for so many reasons, being outside is preferred. Now, specific to COVID-19, there are some very early studies, and I can't emphasize that these are very early. But there are some very early studies to suggest that outdoor activities are of lower risk than indoor activities. And I think if you think about it, it makes sense. Outdoors, people just tend to be more spaced out, just naturally. There's also questions about to what extent outdoors just reduces the amount of spread that can occur from the respiratory droplets. So I think the bottom line there is what we've learned about COVID-19. Is that not every activity carries the same risk, and the location of even the same activity can change the risk profile. For all of those reasons, being outdoors is preferable.
All right. Sylvia on Facebook says, could Dr. Shaw go over the things to ask about the antibody test before having it done? He mentioned it a while back, and a refresher would be great.
Okay, so antibody testing is perhaps the number one question that comes our way on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, what antibody testing really tells you is not so much whether you've got the infection right now, but it's more about whether you might have had it anywhere from 1 week to 6 months ago. To me, I analogize it to looking in the rearview mirror. That's what the antibody test tells you. The other test that we do, the viral test, is like looking out of your windshield. That tells you what's in front of you right now. The antibody test is the rearview mirror. But unfortunately, not all antibody tests were created equal. Early on, by which I mean just a few weeks ago, some of the antibody tests that were on the market were notoriously unreliable and inaccurate. The U.S. FDA stepped in after having allowed some of those to come on the market and has now started the process of instructing manufacturers to take them off the market. But it's an open question about whether some of those tests are still in use. So just at the baseline, there's an open question about whether the test that your doctor may be using is one of the ones that is extremely reliable or one of the ones that's of dubious quality. You can certainly ask, but it's difficult to know what to do with the answer. If your doctor tells you, oh, we use the Questor XYZ457 machine, well, what does that mean? There's an open question after that. Let's just assume for a moment that your physician's office does use one of the really accurate tests. There's still an open question about what the results mean. Even if you did use one of the accurate tests and you did get a positive result, we still don't really know what the antibodies mean when it comes to coronavirus. Antibodies are proteins that our bodies make naturally that prepare the body to fight off the same infection if it comes back. We don't know scientifically whether the coronavirus that we're dealing with now will behave more like chickenpox, meaning that once you've had it once as a child, you're pretty much protected for life, or whether it's going to behave more like the common cold, meaning just because you had it in January doesn't mean you won't get it again in March. And scientifically, we're not sure what those antibodies in your blood might mean, how long they might last for, and what type of intense response they could mount if the coronavirus comes back. So there's a lot of open questions. Right now, there's more questions than answers with antibody testing. There's still a value for it, certainly in a research setting at a population level, but at an individual level, my recommendation is that if your physician is recommending antibody testing, you ask a lot of really hard questions. Namely, what type of machine are you using? Is it one of the ones that the FDA has said produces good results? And then doctor or physician's assistant, what are these results going to tell you different from what you know already?
We're speaking with Dr. Nirav Shah, who's the director of Maine's CDC. More of your questions when we get back. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Flick the Tick, committed to helping you social distance from ticks and insects with DEET-free repellent that's made in Maine. FlickTheTick.com. And Breakwater in Portland, offering summer day camp programs for kids ages 3 to 18. Registration at enrichment.breakwaterlearning.org.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, would you volunteer to be infected with the coronavirus to test a potential vaccine?
Many of the people that I have seen volunteer to be a subject in a human challenge trial seem to think that they are low risk. We know so little about this virus other than that it can be lethal.
The ethics of human challenge trials. That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
And that's coming up tomorrow afternoon at 2 and Sunday evening at 11 here on Maine Public Radio.
Hello, this is Yo-Yo Ma. The last few months have been deeply sad, challenging us in ways we could not have imagined. Now, I invite you to join me for music of beauty, strength, and consolation as I play Bach's 6 cello suites, a memorial for those we have lost, and a tribute to our resilience in a live performance from WGBH in Boston.
And that's coming up Sunday afternoon at 3 on Maine Public Classical.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Maine CDC Director Nirav Shah is our guest. He is updating us on the latest in the state's response to the coronavirus pandemic. We invite you to be part of the conversation. You can email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We have a couple related questions about transmission, and I wanted and the R rate. So I'm going to go to both of those. I'll start with an email from Fred. Well, Maine has had a comparatively low mortality and hospitalization rate. It now has the worst R rate in the entire Northeast. That's the factor that represents how close we are to rapidly escalating virus transmission. Why is Maine behind on this metric? And are you concerned that Maine will flip back to uncontrolled spread given the moves now being made to increase human interactions?
So that's a good question. And the rate that Fred is referring to is a measure of how many cases there are for each individual given case. Unfortunately, the way that those rates are calculated by many of the groups out there doesn't really take into account the differences between community transmission and congregate care transmission. What's really happened in Maine recently is that we have increased our testing so much more significantly than other states have on a per capita basis. And when you go out to search for things in public health or in life generally, you find them. And so what we're doing now is finding cases that almost certainly existed before, but rather than having them lie in wait and not really be detected, we're diagnosing them, we're confirming them, and we're putting a name to them. That comes on some websites with the unfortunate benefit of having our numbers skyrocket, and on some other websites having the number of secondary cases look like it's increased. What's more likely to be happening is more what's called testing bias. That being said, I should be clear that we also know that there are more cases being generated out there. Now, what direction the slider goes, is it predominantly more testing that's leading to the cases, or is it more transmission that's leading to the cases? That's a very difficult question to answer in the moment. It's usually something that we're not really able to tease out until well after an outbreak is over and all the data have come in.
All right. And here's a related tweet from Al. I would like to better understand the focus on positivity percentage or how or if it's related to the R0 number. If positivity percentage falls to around 2%, will R0 fall to 1 or below?
Great. Wow, what a great question.
We have smart listeners.
no doubt about it. So the answer is that those two values indeed are related. But through one critical linkage, which is the ability of individuals to isolate themselves after they've tested positive. So first on the positivity rate, this is something that my colleagues and I at state health departments across the country, it's one of the metrics that we think to be an important one and that we follow on an occasional basis. Every week or a couple of times a month, we always want to check in on what our positivity rates are. The reason is that is one of the best factors that tells us how wide the net that we are casting really is. The goal that at least I've set for myself is to get that figure down to about 2%. The reason for 2% is that is what the country of South Korea achieved as part of their successful effort to suppress and contain coronavirus. Right now, our rate in Maine is right around 5.5%. So we've got more work to do ahead of us. That being said, it has fallen by a pretty significant margin just in the past week. So we're headed in the right direction. The linkage between those two, between the transmission of the disease and the positivity rate, is as follows. If we are able not only to test everyone that we believe to be having a high likelihood of being positive, but also get them into isolation safely so they're not spreading it, then necessarily both the positivity rate will go down, that's a good sign, because we're testing more people, as well as the ongoing transmission, because those folks are being asked to be in isolation. So those two are very linked, both mathematically as well as practically.
All right, we're going to go to Carolyn, who's calling from Presque Isle. Hi, Carolyn, go ahead.
Yes, I'm wondering if a difference has been noted among those patients who have had COVID-19, those who have had a pneumonia shot and those who have not. It's a difference in outcome.
That is an outstandingly good question. You know, just about a week or two ago, I was able to participate on a call where that question is now being looked at. Thus far, it's really too early to be able to have told a difference or observed a difference in the rate of people getting COVID-19, whether they've had a pneumonia shot or not, or if they have gotten it, how severe their disease might be, whether they've needed to be hospitalized or whether their outcomes have been worse. But I can tell you that is something that's being looked at. We generally know that having pneumonia in general can then put someone at risk for then getting COVID-19 because their immune system is already weakened. So it's sort of a 1-2 punch, which is something we want to avoid. So I do really strongly urge everyone who's eligible to get the pneumonia shot to make sure they get it.
Carolyn, thanks for your call. We have another Carolyn asking a question on Facebook. I have a clothing retail shop in the Old Port, and I'm preparing to reopen in early June. Would steaming clothing with a professional steamer that produces steam hotter than 220 degrees be an effective option for treating clothing that has been returned? How likely is it that the virus could be transmitted via soft surfaces such as fabrics?
That's a great question, Carolyn. Similar to the earlier discussion around surfaces, there's still a lot that's unknown about the extent to which surface transmission can contribute to either individuals or larger scale outbreaks. And because there are still open questions, the recommendation from a lot of public health authorities is to make sure we're doing everything to reduce whatever risks there might be to as low as possible. As a previous caller or emailer noted, we've learned a little bit more about surface transmission. And even though it wasn't thought to be a significant driver of outbreaks, it seems now that it's even a lower risk. But to your fundamental question about precautionary measures like steaming the clothing? It's a good question. I don't know that there is a clear-cut answer. Certainly, it could enhance the safety of any of the products that you're selling. I'm not sure exactly at what temperature point the virus can perish, but certainly the hotter it is, the higher likelihood the virus will perish. But just how much doing so, engaging in that steaming process, lowers the overall risk, I'm not sure if really the public health scientific community has a firm answer for you on that yet.
All right. We'll go to Tom, who's calling from Freeport. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi. My question is, regards folks who live in assisted living facilities that have had zero cases of COVID-19 since the beginning of March, and their inability to have some social freedoms, and in the sense that they're essentially going stir crazy by being locked down in a healthy environment. And I understand there's, of course, there's psychological and mental things, but my question is, without a vaccine, when can we expect to have some of these individuals who have the ability to socially distance responsibly get out of their rooms?
Tom, that's a really good question. We've talked about that, as you can imagine, because there's a balance between making sure we keep people safe from a virus and then not introduce a pandemic within a pandemic of individuals being lonely or isolated in some way or not being able to have visitors come and advocate and care for them. You're referring to assisted living, but I'll lump in or add into on top of that long-term care facilities as well. So it's definitely a challenge. Right now, where we are with increasing cases, for example, in the Freeport area or in other more densely populated counties, I think it's the view, or at least my own view, that right now where we are, allowing visitation, for example, at long-term care facilities could introduce risk. The reason I say that is that there's been emerging data just in the past few weeks suggesting that within the types of facilities that you're asking about, Tom, assisted living or, again, I'll add on top of that, long-term care, many of the outbreaks that do start are initiated by outsiders, whether they be employees or, in some cases, visitors or contractors, other visitors to the campus. And so what we've seen recently is that some of these outbreaks, for example, one in Waldo County, as well as another at the Maine Veterans Home, can be absolutely devastating. And so for right now, given the high numbers of transmissions that we're having, my sense is that it's probably better to err on the side of caution.
We have a related question from Charlie on Facebook, and this is somebody, he's talking about his mother who tested positive and is fully recovered, but hasn't been allowed out of her room just to go out to the patio. He wants to know, when will she be allowed to leave the building? When would people be allowed to visit? What is the criteria that will drive these timelines?
Sure. So I can't speak to any one particular case. What I can say in general is that depending on where the facility is, there might be different metrics in terms of when things like being able, as the previous caller, Tom, noted, being able to ambulate and get around the facility overall. So some of that does depend on where the specific location of the facility is. The more challenging aspect of that is the visitation piece. So having folks within a facility socialize, it presents a different risk profile than having outsiders come in, specifically visitors. And even with things like temperature checks and hand washing and hand sanitizer, what we've seen in, frankly, too many situations across the country is that outbreaks can be brought in or COVID-19 can be brought in by visitors. And in a population that can be somewhat densely packed, especially with folks who might be medically vulnerable, what we've seen in so many settings across the country is that facilities like that, whether they're assisted living or long-term care, can quickly become tinderboxes.
Mm. And when you talk about whether or not the patient or the resident is ambulatory, you're basically saying, can this person go outdoors on their own without needing the aid of somebody who's a staff member, right?
That's correct. That's correct.
So a different calculation, depending what your answer is to that.
Mm-hmm.
An email from Andy. Given the anecdotal evidence that recovery from COVID-19 doesn't always provide immunity from reinfection, why do we feel that antibodies produced in reaction to a vaccine will provide that immunity?
It's an open question. That is exactly the right question to ask. That's why the vaccine's got to be really well studied. And right now, there is an open scientific question as to whether the vaccine will be one that you get once and that provides very, very long-lasting immunity, whether it's one you might need to get a couple of times, like, for example, hepatitis A, and then you're good for a very, very long time, or whether it will be a seasonal vaccine, much more akin to the flu vaccine. There's a lot of research going on about that. I did want to just clarify one thing in the stem of that question, which is, based on everything we know right now, once someone has recovered, at least for right now, there is no evidence of individuals who have been reinfected. That could change as the seasons change, and if the virus behaves more like the flu virus and has a different seasonal look, that might change. But based on where we are right now, when someone has recovered, there's no evidence that they can be reinfected.
All right. Well, we are speaking with CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah, and he's answering your questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm and proud to be part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial. DeadRiver.com. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
Arctic explorer and Maine resident Donald Baxter McMillan transfers the schooner Bowdoin to the U.S. Navy for the duration of World War II on May 22, 1941. He initially served as the commanding officer before being transferred to the Hydrographic Office in Washington, D.C. The Bowdoin was listed as a National Historic Landmark in 1989. The schooner continues to sail today around New England and northward to Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, Labrador, and Greenland as a training vessel of the Maine Maritime Academy.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Roosevelt Campobello International Park and the Island Institute. Happy birthday, Maine! The Daily Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus is scheduled to take place at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Governor Mills is expected to join Dr. Shah at today's briefing. Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page will all bring it to you live. In addition, each day's address is archived at MainePublic.org. For later on-demand viewing or listening, just choose the television drop-down. Again, Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shah and Governor Mills at 2 o'clock this afternoon, and carried here on Maine Public Radio, as well as Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on our program, Maine CDC Director Nirav Shah joins us to take your questions about the latest on the coronavirus pandemic in Maine. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I'm going to read an email from Diane, but there are many questions that are similar to this coming in, Dr. Shah. How are the requirements that businesses are supposed to follow in order to be open being enforced? My daughter works at a major chain that is not enforcing mask wearing, nor is it enforcing social distancing. I'm afraid it's putting her at risk. If this cannot be answered now, perhaps in today's update. Memorial Day weekend is going to have highly populated shopping, I am sure.
That's a question that we think about and has come up a lot, as you would imagine. Enforcement is a challenge. Whether it's public health and edicts or a number of the other sort of rules that are out there, enforcement is a challenge in this situation. It really relies on a couple of things. One is for folks to be vigilant, to make sure that if they see something that they believe to be improper, whether it's a manager or a store that's not abiding by the latest guidelines, that they feel empowered to say something to the management of the store. The other, I think, really essential element is that compliance with these guidelines by all of us is part of a social contract. We expect businesses to comply as part of their duty to help keep the rest of us safe. The piece of that becomes a challenge is what happens when that doesn't happen? What happens when a business is not following all the rules they should? the question that I think we all have to ask is, what would be the optimum enforcement scheme? And my sense is that in the times that I've heard folks observing instances of noncompliance, when something has been said to the management, that's probably the first step. And stores have a strong incentive to want to create a safe working environment for themselves and for their employees. So I think that's the first step. I don't think it needs to be the last step. There are probably steps beyond that, depending on how egregious the noncompliance is. But having a word with whomever is overseeing compliance with these things is a good place to start.
Lee on Facebook, have we learned anything about asymptomatic disease from our universal testing during outbreaks? Specifically, do people who originally test negative eventually develop disease, or do some stay negative?
Yes. So that's a very good question. And there have been almost every week, it seems, that there's more and more data that come out about what we initially called asymptomatic folks. But really what we've seen is that they're probably more pre-symptomatic, which is, as was noted, a lot of folks who test negative later go on to develop symptoms. The numbers vary based on the population, but some have. I'm sorry, I said that incorrectly a moment ago. I should clarify. Individuals who test positive but don't have any symptoms at the time that they tested positive, a very high percentage of them. In one study, it was up to 70%. Of those folks who tested positive, even though they didn't have any symptoms, a very high percentage later go on to develop some degree of symptoms. It's different for everybody. So what we really are seeing now is more of a shift away from individuals who are truly asymptomatic and really more toward detecting people who are just pre-symptomatic.
All right. An email from Donna. My husband works at a facility that has had an outbreak. Does it make sense for me to wait 2 weeks before I return to my job?
Well, it's a good question, Donna. We, in epidemiological terms, you are a contact of a contact. And so we don't really, there's not a lot of evidence yet that your husband, who may or may not have symptoms, could then transmit it over to you. However, if your husband does develop symptoms, then unfortunately you would also have to join him for a period of time inside while he's recovering and while you would be waiting to see if you develop symptoms. But at this time, individuals who are contacts of contacts, like she is, need not go inside for the entire period. But the second that the person that they live with develops symptoms, then they would need to. Certainly out of an abundance of caution, if you wish to stay inside, that would also be acceptable. It's not a requirement, though.
Marie on Facebook asks, have the contact tracing and lab jobs been posted? I keep hearing that people are being hired, but I haven't seen any job postings on the state jobs website.
I believe that they have. We have hired additional lab staff, and we have continued to build out our team of contact tracers. Some of it involves hiring. Some of it involves working with volunteers who wish to work with us full time. And so it's a mixture of both. I did want to, and I believe they are being posted. If they haven't yet been, more will be in the very near future. It's a rolling basis, a rolling process. So what I wanted to just underscore for everyone is, although there's a lot of discussion about contact tracing in the news, rightfully so, Maine CDC has always engaged in contact tracing for each and every COVID-19 patient that's been diagnosed for us. What we're planning to do now is build out that force of contact tracers in a stepwise fashion. We know we're going to have more cases, if for no other reason than we're testing so much more. And so what we're hoping to do is, in a stepwise fashion, build out the number of individuals gradually over the next several weeks to months who are available and are engaged fully in contact tracing. It's not so much the flipping of a switch. It's more that we're turning up the dial that was already set pretty high.
We're going to go to Frederick in Bath. Hi, Frederick. Go ahead.
Well, hi, Jennifer. And I first have to say thank you to Dr. Shaw for his most extraordinary expertise and care for us all. My wife and I are actually somewhat stranded in Arizona visiting her family, and we're planning on returning. Now, we've bought a plane ticket to come back a week from Monday on American Airlines, and through a long conversation with American, they have assured me that they're going to sell every available ticket that they have, well, every seat that they have available. So we understand that to fly to Philadelphia will not be much of a problem due to the demand. However, that flight to Portland from Philadelphia is going to be a smaller plane, and it's about 90 minutes, as anyone knows who's done that trip. And, Doctor, I wonder if you would have considerations and how serious to be on a plane for 90 minutes.
You know, unfortunately, Frederick, I don't have great news for you. I also don't have a solution for you. So first, the bad news. The bad news is that there hasn't been any really thoroughgoing analysis as to the risk that flying poses. But based on what we know about the dynamics of airflow within planes, which is to say recirculated air and individuals in close quarters, flying is a risk, unfortunately. How great of a risk? I unfortunately don't have a good sense. It, of course, is predicated on who else is on the flight with you. But unfortunately, flying is a risk. That being said, I don't know that I've got an alternative other than when you arrive back in Bath, requiring that you abide by the governor's 14-day quarantine. That 14-day quarantine has shown itself to be extremely effective at protecting others. That is to say, if someone has not developed symptoms in that 14-day period, there's an exceedingly small likelihood that they've still got COVID-19. So that 14-day quarantine period is really critical. Now, Fred, I fully understand that 14-day quarantine period is designed to protect other people. It doesn't so much help you and your wife. But flying, unfortunately, based on where we are right now, does pose a risk.
We'll go to Scott, who's calling from Waterville. Scott, if you could be quick, that would be terrific.
Yes. Hi, Dr. Shah. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Hey, so I got a quick question for you. Now, in reference to and I don't wear a mask for the most part in places just because I don't see the value of it. But having said that, how do you feel about the research that is actually coming out about masks not necessarily being effective for healthy people to wear all the time? As number one, there's new data that's showing up consistently, even sometimes from the CDC.
Sure, Scott, we're tight on time, so I'm going to let Dr. Shah respond. Go ahead, Dr. Shah.
So based on what we know about face coverings, let alone surgical masks, is that they really do a great job of limiting the ability of someone who's got any kind of infection to spreading it to others. So the mask is really more about protecting others rather than necessarily protecting yourself. There are masks that do protect you. Those are the really highly sophisticated surgical and N95 masks. But simply wearing a face covering, there's virtually no risk to it for 99.9% of the population. And there's good evidence to suggest that in places where you cannot physically distance, putting that face covering on can protect someone from inhaling any of the respiratory droplets that you might be putting out.
All right. Well, I'm going to go very quickly to Marjorie in Camden. Marjorie, if you could ask your question very quickly, that'd be great.
Yes, I'm wondering how many ways there are to test. Is it only the nasal testing? I've heard people say it's very painful. And I'm wondering, someone else said the saliva, she thought there was a saliva test. So I'm wondering how many tests are.
Sure, Dr. Shah, yeah.
Yep. So, Marjorie, great question. The nasal passage test is the mainstay right now, and it is uncomfortable, but it is one of the best ways to get an accurate result. There are other ways to do it. It can be not in the back of the nose, but in the middle part of the nose, and the saliva tests are promising, and hopefully in the next coming weeks they will be in greater fashion and use. They're not quite there yet, but they are the future.
All right. And finally, I'm going to end with an email from Gene because I think you can answer this quickly. When does Dr. Shah plan to revisit his dentist?
That is a good question. Let's see. I'm coming up for my 6-month cleaning in probably about 2 months, maybe 6 weeks from now. So in the very near future.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Nirav Shah, for the director of Maine CDC. And Dr. Shah will be back in just a few minutes to give his daily press briefing that will be here on Maine Public Radio, also on Maine Public Television, and at Maine Public's website. Thank you so much for the time you've spent with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And for more on Maine Public's Deep Dive Coronavirus Reporting Project, go to mainepublic.org/coronavirus. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Today's program will be on again tonight at 7. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.